This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Ever see something you just had to have? Now, that happens a lot to artist Jan Ruwan, but in her case, that must-have item could be a bag of rusty old bells or a pile of greasy pink plastic. She says when she comes across items like these, she sometimes feels an immediate connection to them. And she uses found objects and textiles to make three-dimensional art installations that she hopes speak volumes without saying a word. Jan Ruwan has held fiber arts teaching positions at East Carolina University and North Carolina State University. Her art has appeared in scores of exhibitions in this country and abroad. Her latest work is an exhibition called Observing the Inner Voice, on view at Meredith College, and Jan Ruwan is on the program with us now. Welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be here.
We have just been talking about saving languages,
yes.
And I understand that as a young girl, the last thing you wanted to do is talk.
Yes, I was extremely shy Taiwanese girl. I shy to the point in my kindergarten, I didn't speak a word until one day my mother come to pick me up, and I said, "Teacher, my mother's here." And the teacher was shocked and started in tears. I said, "She can talk." And then sometimes my parents, okay, that's in the living room, asked me to make a speech. Like my younger brother would go and make a speech in front of my parents. And I would start to cry, even facing to my own parents. So I was extremely shy. And I started to discover I can make things and people would start to put meaning in there. And they actually put their own voice into the thing I made. And so they explain what I'm making. To me, that's a way for me to communicate.
Yeah.
And I learned this kind of skill by making things to make sense around me when I was little.
And you were born on Taiwan.
I born in Taiwan.
And you were growing up there. So talk more about this, your consciousness or your awareness of this. I mean, obviously, I would think you were aware of the fact that you were shy and didn't like it when you were asked to talk. That's one thing. You noticed that you liked to make things.
Yes.
When did you notice that this was a form of expression, that this was actually something that people were inferring their own meaning from or imputing their own meaning?
Yeah, I think after I finished all my degree and looking back to prepare a talk, and I realized the moment in my life in 12th grade, I did something really aggressive, which I'd never done it before. And that's the way for me to express my emotion to the object. And so the story is when in the 12th grade in Taiwan, we have a very intense national exam. So after the exam, I was frustrated. I was trying really hard, but I was probably not doing too well. So I got home, I was so angry, I took a scissor and cut off my canvas bag, school bag, in pieces. And after 1 hour, violently, and I started to shock. And then I said, oh, what have I done? I was like such an obedient Taiwanese girl, a daughter. So I start to stitch them together and find my favorite doll and make a garment for my doll. And so I have to find an excuse to put it together and decorate them with my mommy's button collection. And when my parents got home, they say, oh, wow, she's good in fashion design. Let's send her to fashion school. And that's how I started my fashion design, training. And so looking back in my life, it's like, I don't know what I want because I don't know the whole spectrum of life, but I kind of delete things I know I don't want and I want more and I don't know what do I want more. So I keep searching and keep searching and keep trying different things.
So were you also making things, apart from the outrage in that moment, you making things before?
Yeah, I in school I have to memorize book and history. I start to do a little drawing. After I finish drawing, I kind of remember the story. Like a word doesn't really connect to me that strongly. I cannot really remember. But if I draw a little figure about this country attack that country at the end of drawing, I can remember.
Get all the dates and the times and the timeline. Well, tell us more about, because you started out then in fashion design. What about about that process? And then what led you to become an artist?
Yeah.
Not that fashion design isn't art, but.
As a matter of fact, when I was little, my teacher already told my parents I can never be an artist because when we in school, we have to do the Chinese calligraphy. Every time I do the calligraphy, I have the ink all over my uniform. And the teacher will send me back home and said, this kid can never be an artist because she cannot write well. She cannot draw the way we wanted her to be. So I know I'm not going to be an artist. But when I was in fashion program, I love making it. I love the sound of sewing machine. I love stitching. I love drapery on the sculpture form. But I really don't like decorating myself, like the trend, like fashion. What's popular now, what's not popular now. So that part I don't like. but I do like making things. And then I decided to find more outside Taiwan. So I applied to the School of Art and Steel of Chicago. And that's the place that changed my life. And
that's a renowned art school. That is a school that has quite a reputation. What were you expecting to happen there, and what really did
know.
Happen?
That's the power of unknown, because I don't know what will happen. I only know I like making things. So I tell my parents, that's after like 3 years family revolution and fighting, I told my dad, let me go for 3 years. I will come back. And that's like 25 years ago.
Mm.
So he let me go to study fashion design. Of course, the Art Institute program has a fashion design and fiber art, and it's a very good art school. So I kind of find a legit reason to, I'm going to progress my education in fashion design, because they are going to worry if you can find a job.
Mm-hmm.
So I was double major in fashion design and fiber art. And the first time I saw the indigo dye out of sync, the color changes and just emerge from the cloth. It's just so much human embedded in that, I just cannot let go. So I died like 3 hours. And my professor at the time, John Livingston, who is a sculptor, she asked my friend, is she okay? Is she like nuts? Because I keep dying. And then I just don't know how long I can create in the School of Art and Design. And then every time teacher give you one project, I will do 3 projects.
So what's great about this is now you can be covered in indigo and you're considered a great artist.
Yes, yes.
Unlike the calligraphy or ink that you... So, but tell us more about this, because I said in the introduction, and I think it's true, that you have this relationship with material. You talked about textile art. Talk about this feeling you get, this sense that you get when you look at material like this.
Yeah. So most of the material I found, most of it's abandoned. And I feel like they are kind of a community being abandoned by our society. So, for example, the one in the exhibition in Carey Art Center, and there's one also in the Meredith College, the pink plastic I found. I actually went to the NC State surplus store to see if there's some material cheap, like big quantity, and I couldn't find anything. So I went to the dumpster. There's a box and box of stuff next to the dumpster, so I don't want to sell it. And I open up, it's those sticky pink plastic being stuck together. And because it's pink and it's been abandoned, so I took it home, and it's free, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I washed each sheet and started printing on them. And I feel like a lot of materials, because it's not popular anymore, so it's been outdated in society through manufacture, and they lost their identity. And I feel like a sense of rescue them to give them a new identity. So I took them home, think about what can I create to give it a new life.
To what extent do you feel like you're giving it an identity, and to what extent do you let the material tell you who it is?
Yeah, well, not the original scent, but the thing is with the material, people can really relate in the original scent once they look and discover it, and then they'll start to think about why been changing this way. So I always transform the material, not the original state, but push the limit what I can do.
Talk about some of the pieces in the Meredith exhibit, observing the inner voice that's part of the display. Talk about some of those pieces and how they came about. I'm particularly interested in kneeling, for instance.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So the kneeling piece actually is the latest my work.
Mm-hmm.
And I was inspired by the space. When I go into space, there's four panel skylight. And the director, Lisa, say, oh, we can never turn off the lights because of skylight. And I got inspired by the uplifting kind of feel to the space. And I decided to create a centerpiece. Almost looks like altar in the shrine area. And also this year and last year, my mind feels sad and pondering with all our immigration policy, the old broken family, all the white people want to immigrate to this country, they want a better future for the children, and the family being torn apart. So I start to print on this pink plastic, and I cut it into pieces. So it's like a shape. Then I resole them together with cotton binding together. So the only thing holding them is a line all the way around. And then it was suspended around this chair, and which accidentally, I found this chair on sale online. And after the conversation, because the shape looks very interesting, so I asked about it, and the owner said, oh, it's a great conversation piece. It's a chair for shoe shining. And I said, wow. All of a sudden, the shoe shining became very important, because when ordinary people sit on the shoeshine chair, you feel like a throne, right? You're sitting on top, and someone serving you touch the dirtiest part of your shoes to shine and serve you. And those kind of reciprocal relationship, the one being elevated, they're both being elevated. One is being served and one is served. And that kind of relationship kind of relate to a religion or society. And I just fascinated by this. So like, it's a perfect match for this piece.
It is. Now, I'm only looking at the photograph. This is an actual installation that you would see at Meredith College. But the photograph is really stunning in a way, in the subtlety of it. It's beautiful, so it catches your eye. You want to look at it some more. And then you begin to make out the objects. And then finally the postures. And then some of what you're saying, this chair in the center being in some ways honored. Mm-hmm. And yet the kneeling figures are larger than the chair. And so you wonder who is the boss here, right? So it's the subtlety of it as you convert this material, which had been mostly cast off or deeply reduced on clearance, as it were. How much of that takes shape? How much of that is instantly apparent to you as you start the project? And how much of it sort of happens as you produce the work?
Most of my work evolved over time because the process or the repetition, people can look at the work and they know it takes a lot longer time, takes a lot of time, and which is good in a way. I can keep thinking the piece when I'm making it. So it's a meditative process as well as for me to re-sketch the final outcome.
How much a part does religion play in your work?
I think it's more about spirituality. So there's a lot of work related to spirituality versus mundane human body and how I look at life in a Taoist way, like a way to balance in universe. So that's
a... You raised Buddhist?
I was raised Buddhist and Taoist in Taiwan. In Taiwan, it's a very small island. It's only 1/4 size of North Carolina. But we have a 12,000 registered official temple.
Oh, okay.
So it's a lot of temples. So, and it's all like kind of mixed together. So you don't really distinguish that much unless you're a scholar. Mm-hmm. So...
Well, tell me more about this one now, if you would talk about this piece.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. The earlier speaker talked about preserving language. And this piece is called Guanyin, to observing your inner voice. And one of the things, the Buddha's God, the goddess of mercy, who can hear you crying and who can hear your voice when you need help. And she will come to appear to you to rescue you. And to me, the most important thing, she can even hear you, even you don't have voice to call out. So in a way, I like the idea of silence voice. So I put a lot of rusty bell deep in the wax, so they don't make any sounds.
Where did you find the rusty bells? Did you make them rusty?
Make them rusty bell. It's a funny story. So I tried to find something cheap for one of my projects. Mm-hmm. So I ordered some bells on sale on Google. It's on sale many years ago. And I ordered it, and I opened it, and it's all rusty. It's like, when you open the bag, it's like powder everywhere. It's, oh, that's why it's on sale, and I cannot use it. So, okay, I'm going to seal with wax. So I tie the deal string and dip in the wax. And the moment I dip in the wax, it falls into silence. And it's like, wow, that's a eureka moment. That's so perfect. Then the bell can make a sound. So then later I use a lot of silent bell in my work. Like when I cannot speak, I'm still present in the space. So the piece for the Meredith College, the Observing Inner Voice, the woven piece carry a lot of silent bell with the goddess who is coming from the wall to receiving you when you're facing the piece. And also the other show I have in Carry Art Center has a piece called The Shadow We Made, The Noise We Made. And it's a house of a little silent bell, thousands of them together into the whole space.
Do you spend time in silence every day and in something we might call meditation or at least a kind of programmed silence where you say to yourself, no talking for the next hour?
Not anymore. No. I have a 6-year-old daughter, so it's very hard.
Because I wonder in what way, now that you found a way to truly express yourself in a way that other people understand and appreciate, how you feel about words and whether or not they in some ways can interfere with the understanding of what you're doing. Do you have to sort of make words go away as you're working?
Actually, when I'm working, it's the best meditation time. Yeah. When I'm making folding and sewing and repetitive process, which come from traditional textile, it's a time I can really think and really meditate without making any sound. in every day, I'm a horrible Buddhist student. My father tried to teach me when I was little to meditate, and I have insomnia. So if I keep focus on that, it actually get worse. But when I actually doing something, yeah. my mind become quiet and it's very silent. And I love other people use their word to interpret my work because I find that, wow, I never think about that's the way to say this thing or how they feel. And that's how I want to create my work to communicate and connect with people. Because when they work in the space, they see the object, they feel it resonates with their memory and start to trigger their own emotion. And that's the goal of my work, to for them to experience in space. And a lot of time people say, why don't I put like long statement on each word to talk about it? But I feel if I do that, you limit their imagination. Mm-hmm. And I prefer that to experience first. It's like, I tell you this dish tastes so good, but you haven't tried it. You only know the ingredient.
Mm. So, got it. Well, that's the problem. Yeah. Sometimes that can happen too if you happen to be good with words.
Yeah.
The problem is that you want to see the thing in terms of the words and you miss the moment when it actually spoke to you more deeply.
Yeah.
So good for your work and thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Jan Ruwan is a mixed media artist living in Chapel Hill. Her exhibition, Observing the Inner Voice, is on view at Meredith College in Raleigh until March 5th. And of course, we've got all the information at our website, stateofthings.org. For our next Movies on the Radio, we're talking about your favorite gangster movie. Maybe New York crime families, could involve the mafia, could involve other gangs. Godfather, Goodfellas, top of your list. Movies on the Radio, the next one. Gang movies, send us your email at sot@wnc.org or tweet at us at #SOTMovie. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Jennifer Brooklyn is a producer as well, and Robin Copley is our technical director with Jenny Lawson engineering the show today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.